From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Leanne Hansen, substituting for Terry Gross, who's on vacation. Today, I speak with Bill Raymond, a member of the experimental theater group Mabu Minds. Their innovative combination of theater and performance art have earned them close to 20 Obie Awards, Off-Broadway's highest honor. Also today, a conversation with actress and world champion baton twirler Sophie Hayden. She starred in Shakespeare's The Comedy of Errors, which was broadcast on the television series Live from Lincoln Center. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews the new album from the Kronos Quartet, and language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg tells us how he learned to speak a foreign language by going to the movies. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. My guest is Bill Raymond, who is a member of Mabu Minds, one of America's leading avant-garde theater troupes. For over 20 years, Mabu Minds productions have successfully combined both the color and drama of theater with the concepts and techniques often associated with performance art. Every one of their productions is a collaborative effort. Members of the company not only direct, design, and perform, they raise funds and have also been known to type and to answer the telephone. Bill Raymond is in Philadelphia as part of the Festival of American Theater and Art called Only in America. He will be appearing in the Mabu Minds production of Cold Harbor, a play in which he portrays Ulysses S. Grant. Earlier this year, his performance as Grant earned him Off-Broadway's highest honor, the Obie Award. Welcome to Fresh Air, Bill Raymond.
Thank you, Leanne. Thanks for having me here.
I think it might be helpful for us if you could just briefly set up the play for us. What happens?
Okay. Imagine, if you will, less with imagination, our swift scene. Right. Okay. The play itself is two plays, and they are two plays which run simultaneously. There is the play of the curators, which is play A, and there is the play of Grant, which is play B. And the curators and Grant relate or interrelate to each other obliquely. The curators relate to Grant directly, looking at him, sort of an audio animatronic figure. The myth of Grant, the mythic notion of Grant, the metaphor of Grant as a metaphor for war, for the warrior, for some archetypal notion of a warrior.
You're enclosed in a glass case.
So yes. So what happens is the event of the evening is the putting together an exhibit on and about the life and times of Ulysses S. Grant. And in that putting together, we see a way of seeing the history. We see a way of presenting, and we see that how we present is how we see.
Before we get into a discussion of all that, what the play means and what it is the company's trying to say and what you're trying to say about Grant, give us a little bit of general Ulysses S. Grant.
What happens is Grant runs on his own. And there's a point at which, we talk about Jefferson Davis. Grant talks about Jefferson Davis. Dale Worsley talks about Jefferson Davis.
And he's the author of the play.
And he's the author of the play. And when we perform this speech in Charleston, Carolina, the Daughters of the Confederation walked out in a big huff. I thought cannon were going off, which is the doors slamming. And they really didn't like me talking this way about Jeff Davis.
No kidding.
Jefferson Davis. Now, listen to Jefferson Davis. Now, just before the Civil War, he said, "I will agree to drink all of the blood spilled south of Mason and Dixon Lion if there should be a Wawa." A Wawa. Well, go ahead, you drink it, Jeff Davis. You choke on it. You save me from debt and drinking and the humiliation of working in my father's leather store. You certainly made Julia happy. You sent me into the White House for 8 years. Sent me into Jerusalem on a darn burrow to bigger crowds than he ever saw anyway. The trumpets and the palm leaves made my name so illustrious. People gave me houses in Galena and Philadelphia. 80,000 British mechanics cheered me on the moors of Liverpool. My silhouette was traced in the sky by the pyrotechnics above the Crystal Palace. I sat at the table of England's literary giants. I sat at the table of a Queen Victoria. I was welcome at all the tables of all Europe's nobility. I had countesses, bosoms blazing with diamonds clinging to both of my arms. I sailed around the world. I sailed up the great Nile River. I saw Pompeii. I saw the Mount of Olives. The Parthenon was illuminated in my honor. The Sultan Abdul Hamid gave me 4 Arabian horses. I kissed the ring of the Pope in the Vatican. I saw the Art of Florence, which was a big yawn, if you ask me. I don't know why people need to paint anymore now that we have photography. I saw Venice, which would be tolerable if it were drained. I met Bismarck. I saw Denmark, Norway, Sweden, India, Russia, China. I was the first Westerner allowed inside the Japanese Imperial Palace. I made the United States of America a world power. My tomb, the best known in the country. So, who knows where you're buried, Jeff Davis? Now you see that? That's the simplicity of war. Now that's the joke.
Thank you. My guest is Bill Raymond, who's with the Mabu Mines Company and is portraying Ulysses S. Grant. Powerful man. It's actually been said about him that he is a man more rightly belonging to fiction than fact. Do you agree?
Wow, I never heard that. Why do you say that? What?
He seems so much larger than life, particularly the way that you've been portraying him here in the studio. He just sort of grew in front of me.
Certainly the incidents of his life are the stuff that one might hang a romantic novel on, you know. And there are things. The first line of his memoirs is an old saying: "Man proposes and God disposes." And it seems to me that in reading about him and in reading the memoirs, that he seems to be a fatalistic. And because he was so fatalistic, he could be a man who possessed this pitiless logic. He also seemed to be extremely lucky.
Lucky?
He was, yeah. If you can call getting nearly killed being lucky, I guess that's lucky compared to getting killed. But he was also extremely unlucky. But he was lucky in that, you know, after a raid on the rebels, he was chased back to the steamer on which they were traveling. The men ran on, he ran his horse up onto the plank, got off the horse, completely winded, ran into the captain's cabin, lay down on a couch, and for no reason at all, got up again. And the moment he got up, a cannonball went right through the couch. He was he was in Brady's studio. And
he's the photographer.
Yes,
Brady, yeah.
And there was a skylight directly above him. So he was sort of rushed in to have he had just come back from some great victory to be appointed the general of the armies. This was sort of now that happened late in the war. It was at least 60. I think it's 1863. My history serves me, but my memory never does. But and he was sitting, having his portrait taken by Brady, and again, for no reason, sort of stood up. And the moment he stood up, a shard of glass from the skylight came crashing down and stuck right in the floor, directly next to where he was sitting.
Did you do a lot of research before you got interested in the play, or did you sort of were you sort of interested in him? Because he's really an enigma, someone that he has a reputation,
yeah.
But it turns out that this reputation was not at all like what the man really was. Did you start off with that hunch, or were you actually reading about him before you decided to do this?
Well, I got interested in him through the memoirs. I started reading the memoirs, and I was interested. I was casting about for a piece of work to do. I had this, you know, this like impulse. I wanted to work, and I wanted to initiate a piece. And I knew a couple of things. I knew that I wanted to work in a so-called fact, And I knew that I wanted to work in a larger form. And starting to work on Cold Harbor, I had done a piece called A Prelude to Death in Venice by Lee Brewer, Mabu Mines production, and which is one of my favorite plays in the world. And I love doing that. And it's still alive today, Prelude. But it's mic'd, and it's very close and very intimate and very sort of movie psychological and natural and, yeah, surrealistically realistic, you know, and like that. And it was all very, you know, there's a little puppet, and the puppet talks on these little play phones. They're two phones, you know, and he talks back and forth between, and manifests a dozen personalities as the need arises for whoever he happens to be pretending he's talking to, you know.
So it was the sort of
madness. And I wanted to break out of that. And I knew that I liked. I mean, Grant became a fascinating character to me, I felt that I could identify with this guy, as apparently many people do.
Identified with him in
which
way?
Well, I could identify with him in terms of the depths of his failure and the heights of his success. Although, you know, I'm not the president of the United States, nor am I a butcher.
No. Well, he has a reputation as a butcher, but history's kind of rewriting that reputation.
Well, there's some revision coming in because there was a great tendency to dismiss him because of the corruption in his during his administrations, both of them.
But he didn't pay any attention
enormous.
To it. He didn't really know what was going on.
That was his failure. I mean, he was not terribly. He didn't pay a lot of attention. It took a lot to get his attention. You know, like war was one of those things that did. I have a few little theories about that that's the only thing that sort of got him excited and got him off. He was a failure at just about every civilian thing he attempted, including the presidency, you know.
Although, he sold wood in St. Louis, and he was a failed businessman. Mm-hmm. He really didn't know what to do with himself outside of a war.
One would assume that, you know, from the events. He also had psychological problems. He was asked to leave the army, this greatest general of the Civil War, you know, from the North's point of view. Of course, I just spent some time in Richmond, and you get another vision of the war from that side. I mean, and also in Charleston, you know. The street, Monument Avenue, is lined with Civil War heroes. You know, it's quite amazing. You know, the men who died in the war, in battle, face north, and the men who came home face south.
Really?
Yeah. You know, like Jackson, who was killed by his own fire, friendly fire. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you know that story, but
no.
I mean, there are a lot of stories, but I've sort of gotten off. I tend to be elliptical, as they say in the newspaper.
well, let's talk about the piece itself. It's set in a museum, and in fact, the action, if you can really call it that, is the setting up of this exhibit. And at one point, the curators are talking about what to leave in and what to leave out. Is this sort of a metaphor for us, for society as a whole, for history as a whole, in that we're rather selective in what we decide to remember?
Well, I think that's true. There was William McFeely wrote a book called Grant, a biography, and we used that book for research, among a few others. But he was a principal. That was a principal book that we used, and he came to see the piece in Ohio and sat on a panel with us, and later became extremely interested in it, and has been a great supporter. In fact, is on the board now of we're trying to make a piece of Cold Harbor for video, especially for video. And so he organized a panel in Holyoke, I guess it is, Mount Holyoke College, where he was. These sort of heavyweight historian intellectual types showed up, and Dale and I were sitting there sort of daunted, but it was all right. Of course, what they were talking about was the role of the actor, the role of the playwright, and the role of the historian in terms of fidelity to history or to the facts, and what is, and then, you know, like we're with all these heavy heads, you know, and and in 3 minutes into the discussion, and somebody says, "Well, yeah, but what is real life?" You know, I mean, what is real life? Wait a minute, wait a minute. We did that in the sixth grade, right? And,
so by dissecting it too much, you're almost losing the beauty of what you're trying to do.
I don't know if that's the case. I just know that it's hard to get at what really it is that happened. And all you can do is say, well, they say this happened, and this we can conclude. And you must be selective, because in the telling of any story, you have to say, well, this is important and this isn't. And when you're telling a history, then you have to say, this is important and this isn't. So there is that process. And it's not necessarily a negative one, but it's certainly one that is determined by one's own experience, you know?
My guest is Bill Raymond. He's a member of the Mabu Mines Company. He is performing as General Ulysses S. Grant in a production entitled Cold Harbor. We'll continue our conversation after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
I'm speaking with Bill Raymond. He is performing in the play Cold Harbor, which is based on the memoirs of General Ulysses S. Grant, and it's a production that is being mounted by the Mabu Mines Theater Troupe. In this play, Cold Harbor, and I'm going to quote from the script, actually, Grant says, "I'm credited with the first use of complete annihilation as a strategy of war. At this moment, we anxiously await the resurrection of that strategy in the service of a just cause." What does that mean? Are you saying something now about sort of American political strategic thinking?
Well, I imagine there are a lot of generals sitting down there, and or maybe standing, anxiously awaiting the outcome of the Persian Gulf, for example, or Nicaragua, for example, or North Korea, South Korea, or are there any other hot spots around? South Africa, Chad.
It's everywhere you look, there's another another hot spot.
Everywhere there's an emerging country, there's conflict. And everywhere there's the possibility of turning a buck, there's conflict. And everywhere there's a possibility of having a strategic advantage, there's conflict. Afghanistan, you know, is another one. And it's not so simple to say don't fight. But you know something, that really is the answer, isn't it? I mean, somehow or another, one has to come around to that conclusion, that you have to say, we have to find a way to not fight. We have to find a way to be free and not fight. We have to find a way to be healthy and not fight. We have to find a way to survive and not fight. We have to find a way for the four freedoms to work everywhere in the world, as you know, Roosevelt said.
Seems like Mabu Mines has been saying that for the last 20 years.
Well, I suppose, you know, We're not a self-proclaimed political anything, you know. I mean, and in fact, a long time ago, we decided to be apolitical, to say I have no point of view about the Republican Party or the Democratic Party or communism or, you know, whatever.
But you don't
say you're not a humanist. And if you're a humanist in this day and age, and humanity being threatened as it is, a point of view must come to the fore, and that does. And then, if you say, you know, save humanity, you have a political point of view in this day and age, because it's certainly at risk.
At risk because it won't get financed?
Because it won't get financed, because we don't know what to do with all the nuclear garbage. It's at risk because the waters are being polluted.
Right.
It's at risk because the nuclear warheads are being bought, because we live in a forced economy, because the economy is a wartime economy, and we're supposedly living in peace. If you're living in a wartime economy, you have to have some place to put those bombs. and those missiles, and you know, you got to spend them some way, or they become obsolete, and then what do you do with the nuclear garbage? You know, and of course, you know, you have to make plutonium in order to have more nuclear garbage, you know. And I suppose another way to do it is to escalate the spending, you know, to make it faster. So we could actually escalate it by having Star Wars. You can spend a lot more money that way. But it's a shame that, I mean, if we have to have such high taxes, and I know that taxes have just been cut for some people.
Well, you're talking
that it would be nice if we spent them on education and libraries and research and medicine and those countries which are starving and building them up and helping them in some way. I know that that's the American goal and the American ideal, and I think that we should follow it.
Is this a point of view that you're taking as Bill Raymond person? And how does this relate to Bill Raymond actor? Bill Raymond is member of a company which is...
How is there any difference?
Well, for example, you are talking now about really broad kind of global issues. And what I'm trying to do is kind of narrow them down and get into you talking about the company that you're in. I mean, you said the company changed. It didn't have a political, decided not to have a political point of view, and it now has an apolitical point of view. Mm. And let's face it, it takes money to put these things on the air. I mean, put these things on stage and mount these things. And it doesn't seem like you've ever compromised that attitude.
But see, that's the great, that is a wonderful part of the United States. I mean, the United States is a wonderful country. It is. There are things that the government does that's not so great. But the concept of it is incredible, right? Mm-hmm. And what I said was that we had early on, and I think I can speak for other people in the company too, but certainly myself, had decided to become apolitical. I did not want to be a part of a large movement of anti-this or anti-that. But in the course of time, the country has shifted, and so that even if our position remains the same, it becomes political because the country has shifted. Absolutely. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
You got an Obie Award.
I got two. Actually,
you got two.
The company has gotten, I can't remember. I think it's 18 now.
18 awards.
Yeah, 18 Obies.
Do you ever feel like this award kind of might legitimize you in some way? More people might be willing to pay attention?
Terrific.
Yes.
If that happens, sure, of course, everything helps. If someone comes to the theater and writes about the piece in a way that you sort of intended it to be seen, it's so wonderful. If they write about it in a way that you didn't think it was going to be seen, but it's a completely valid point of view, so much the better, because then there is a frame of reference. When someone who has read that article or review or those ideas about the piece come, then they can see it in that light as well as bringing their own whatever it is to it. Usually the work of Mabu Minds is a kind of work that needs to be worked at. A viewer, the audience needs to work at it a bit. It's a bit of a challenge, I think, sometimes.
It's almost, I'm thinking, I mean, I know the title comes from a South African mining town, but for some reason I thought mines, they're hidden and you step on them and you are surprised, you know?
This is great. This is terrific. First, it wasn't South African. It's Nova Scotia.
Oh, Nova Scotian. I'm
but
terrible.
South African, that sounds terrific. It's very hip.
Now you're going to change the reason why you put this title.
And mines is even better. We never thought of that either. You know, we thought of mines like because it sounded good, first of all.
Instead of mimes, which implies
mimes
face and
is not, you know, and it wanted to be something that was not theatrical, didn't have theater connected to it. We're interested in making something that of our own that was art, that was, you know, that was not in that sort of bailiwick, or more in the real world, like the rock and roll world, or something like that. You know, that I keep hitting this. I'm sorry.
That's all right. Are you still doing commercial voiceover? Did you really do a Roach commercial?
No.
No, that
no,
was just
I didn't.
Publicity hype. That
I was asked to do it, and I said I wouldn't do it. I was too proud at the time. So, and I don't know if I would do it today, but
voiceovers. There are voiceovers. There are things I believe in, you know, as far as selling things.
What have you done?
Nothing.
I mean, which voiceovers have you done?
None.
None. So you're working solely within this company, making
I work in this company. Once in a while, I do a television show or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, but
yeah.
I'm interested in the movies. I like the movies a lot. I always have.
Yeah.
So, you know, but most of my time is taken up with working with Mabu Mines. And thankfully, I'm happy about it.
Do you think it's possible for a company to be commercially successful and still be on that cutting edge?
Well, it depends on who they are and what it is that they do.
Your company, for example, if you got a grant from, say, I don't know, IBM or a big corporation, would you accept it?
Sure. Why not? Why not?
Because some companies and some artists feel it sort of soils their purity.
Well, it does if they tell you what to do. It does if they tell you what to say. It does if they say, well, we won't give you that money if you do that, and then you don't do it. It does, yeah, sure, it will. It does make you vulnerable if that, in fact, is a... But mm-hmm. So far, that really hasn't happened for us. As far as I know, and I guess I know a lot, it hasn't happened. Joe Papp, who is a great theater man, was a patron and continues to be a great supporter of Mabu Mines, and for years gave us a theater every year, you know, to do work. No strings, and no, I'm not. You have to do this. Or he might say, voice an opinion, say, you know, he'd had an opinion about Cold Harbor. He's a great buff of the Civil War and of Grant, and he wanted Grant to be. He said I wasn't giving him a fair shake because he was a better man than I showed him to be. And I said, yeah, but I wasn't trying to do that. Mm-hmm. I was, you know, I really was grinding an axe. And he says, yeah, well, so far. That's never been a problem. No one has ever come to listen. If you do this, don't just leave the stuff out about the communists and the nuclear energy, and then you can have this money. You know, never has happened. And you know, we've been that because there are great people out there. You know,
and you've been allowed to continue, and with any luck,
we've been lucky.
We'll continue.
Yeah, we've been lucky, and I hope we continue to be lucky.
Phil Raymond, thanks very much for coming on Fresh Air today.
Ah, that's it. Thank you for having me. Really.
My guest has been actor Bill Raymond. He's currently performing in Cold Harbor, which is based on the memoirs of General Ulysses S. Grant. He plays General Ulysses S. Grant, and he is a member of the theater group Mabu Mines. I'm Leanne Hansen, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with actress Carrie Fisher. So I hope you can join us. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Leanne Hansen, sitting in for Terry Gross while she's on vacation. Coming up, actress Sophie Hayden. She's also a world champion baton twirler who got to both talk and twirl in the Lincoln Center production of Shakespeare's Comedy of Errors. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews White Man Sleeps, the new album from the avant-garde chamber group The Kronos Quartet. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg tells us how Humphrey Bogart helped him learn Italian. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio. This is Fresh Air. Our classical music critic, Lloyd Schwartz, has a review of the new album from the Kronos Quartet called White Man Sleeps. The group gets its name from the mythical Kronos, an ancient titan who became ruler of the universe. The quartet itself is attracting attention because of its unconventional style and sound.
I'd love to start a nasty rumor about the Kronos Quartet, that on their day off they play nothing but Brahms. Of course, in public they wouldn't touch a note written before Schoenberg. This is the group that started in San Francisco over a decade ago, and they're one of the most popular string quartets in the country today. Their success is really astonishing, considering that they play nothing but 20th century music and specialize in contemporary pieces, often music they've commissioned themselves. In fact, I'm a little suspicious of their popularity, since they're probably better known for their image than for their playing, their antipathy to traditional concert formality, their punk hairdos, leather jackets, and glamour photos, which is okay if they're getting a new audience for the best contemporary music, but not so good if what they commission tends to be trendy, easy on the ear pieces, not only stylistically, but intellectually minimalist. Their new album on Nonesuch, White Man Sleeps, gives a perfect demonstration of what's both valuable and questionable about their enterprise. Most important, they are four distinguished players. They probably hate that phrase. David Harrington and John Sherba on violins, violist Hank Dutt, imagine anyone in the Juilliard Quartet named Hank, and cellist Joan Jeanrenaud. They're dazzling both in their classical refinement and in all the necessary contemporary sonic effects, the infinite varieties of pizzicatos and glissandos, or making their instruments sound like other instruments, drums or whistles or harps or human voices. But the most exciting thing they do is their serious, uncompromising incorporation of jazz and rock into classical string quartet literature. Here's the driving arrangement of Ornette Coleman's Lonely Woman, done for the Kronos by bass player Mel Graves.
Thank you.
Lonely Woman isn't as steamy or riveting as Steve Rifkin's arrangement of Jimi Hendrix's Purple Haze, which made such a splash on the first Kronos album. But it's powerful, moving, not condescending, and it swings. There's also a terrific little scherzo by Charles Ives, and Ben Johnston's haunting and wonderfully inventive variations on Amazing Grace, my favorite thing on the album. Why aren't any notes included to tell us more about these works and composers? The title cuts, White Man Sleeps, numbers 1 and 5, written for the Kronos by a young South African composer, Kevin Volans, are the major disappointment. The sort of obvious, politically naive, the natives are restless music I wish they had less taste for. The Kronos plays 20th century classics, too, and often with great power. But their elegant, at-arm's-length performance here of Bartók's tense, terse third-string quartet sounds a little tame or dutiful compared to, say, the gripping life-or-death playing of the Juilliard. It's as if the Kronos is trying to establish its cultural legitimacy rather than express the depths of this music, whatever the cost. And that's a dangerous thing for any musician to do.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed White Man Sleeps, the new album by the Kronos Quartet. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Sophie Hayden, Broadway actress and former World Baton Champion. At Lincoln Center recently, she played Adriana, the female lead in a circus-like production of Shakespeare's Comedy of Errors. Other cast members included vaudevillians Abner the Eccentric and the Flying Karamazov Brothers. Hayden originated the role at Chicago's Goodman Theater in 1983, and the production has been featured on public television's Live from Lincoln Center. Hayden came to New York to be an actress, but found that her unique skills helped her to get her first big break on Broadway. That was in Barnum, where one of her tricks was to twirl a baton while doing a flying forward somersault, landing on her feet just in time to catch the baton. Hayden began twirling when she was 4. By 16, she was a world-class champion. When I spoke with Sophie Hayden, she told me that she was never a drum majorette or a cheerleader, but set her sights instead on competition.
People don't see it as an event like figure skating or gymnastics because it isn't in the Olympics. Why it's not in the Olympics, I don't know. They've tried for many years to get it in, and it always seemed like an incredible artistic, athletic activity with dancing and gymnastics.
You were the World Baton Twirling Champion of 1971, mm-hmm. and given that you're saying it should be like an Olympic event, was it indeed like an Olympic event? Did you get judged on technique,
showmanship, variety, difficulty created through movement and timing, difficulty created in just actual difficult tricks.
Like the four batons twirling in the air at once.
Right, or if you're doing a solo routine with one baton, there are just some hard tricks, you know, that it takes forever to learn.
Can you describe one?
Well, elbow rolls, like a continuous elbow roll. Elbow to elbow to the neck to elbow to elbow.
And everyone does this and then gets judged on how well they do this particular trick.
Yes, pretty much, and there's variety of ways. The more difficult you can make that trick with flipping it from elbow to elbow and then letting it roll on the back of the neck and then maybe flipping it with the right elbow and doing a whole turn underneath it and then catching it on the left elbow. It's all very complicated.
When you were doing this, competing as a baton twirling champion, going to Italy and Switzerland and South America, competing in baton twirling champions, did it ever occur to you that there was a place for baton twirling in Shakespeare?
No. In fact, when I left twirling, I tried to leave it behind me, so far behind me, because I found that there was, you know, the thing that carried me through from twirling into acting was, of course, a tremendous amount of discipline. tremendous amount of concentration. I mean, I could practice a trick, one trick for hours, so I could work on a couple of lines or, you know, two pages of a scene for hours. And I know friends of mine would be going, oh, my God, how can you work that hard or that long? It was very simple to me. It was what came natural to me. The thing that was very difficult was that twirling and most of athletics is quite serious. You know, I mean, you don't think about having a sense of humor or knowing how to tell a joke well or having to bring your humor forth in because it's dead serious. It's like catching the baton or dropping it. It's like making the time or not making the time.
And this was difficult then to reconcile when you decided to be an actor and
study. Yes, it was
very
That's why I kept being so challenged by acting because it constantly made me have to break through things that I never had to break through all the while I was twirling.
Like what?
Well, I was very shy as a baton twirl. I mean, as a little girl. And to twirl, you could kind of hide behind the baton. You really could. You didn't have to say anything.
Mm.
You could go out in front of the judge and, you know, and your personality does have to come through. But still, you don't have to be very articulate. You don't have to be able to talk about your feelings.
And now look at you. Not only did you have a part twirling the baton and doing Shakespeare at the same time in Comedy of Errors, the first time, or one of the first times you were on Broadway, you were in Barnum, you were twirling your baton.
Right. Those were the two times. And then in between that, I did regular plays. I did new plays, like, you know.
And got very good reviews
here
for
in
them.
New York, and yeah.
Now, in Comedy of Errors, you actually twirl a machete.
Yeah, in the last part of the show, all hell breaks loose. And, of course, no one knows what the correct story is that's going on.
Right. Let me reiterate. Comedy of Errors is the story about mistaken identity. The boys of Syracuse, you have a man and a servant, and they all look alike. And they're all played by the Flying Karamazov brothers.
And Adriana is outraged that she her husband keeps denying that he's her husband. And, of course, it's just a mistaken identity. So what happened is the director wanted me, this is getting towards the end of the play, wanted me to do something really spectacular. And I said, he said, can you twirl the three batons at once? I said, I don't want to twirl three batons at once. But Howard Patterson, one of the Flying Karamazov brothers, happened to be standing in the corner juggling three of these machetes. And I said, Howard, what is that? And he said, it's a machete. We got it in the Far East when we were doing some movie or something. And I said, let me feel it. Let me flip it around. And sure enough, it was balanced real nicely that I could flip it under my leg. I could toss it, turn twice around and catch it. I could flip it under my elbow. I could do lots of exciting things with it. And my rationalization was that Adriana is so overcome with having to explain the truth, her truth, to the Duke, that she goes wild and she takes this machete and she's just explaining the story. And unbeknownst to her, she's causing danger to everyone around her. And it turned out to be quite funny.
Oh, quite funny. Is it dangerous for you to be doing this?
Actually, I slashed my leg one night. And of course, my main memory will always be of that machete routine in that monologue is that if I'd ever really let go of it, it could have flown out into the audience, into the house, and could have really hurt somebody. In fact, when we did it at the Goodman, it was in proscenium.
This is the Goodman Theater in Chicago.
The Goodman Theater in Chicago, right. It was proscenium. So basically, if it went forward of me, then it would go into the house. But the sides were safe, and the back was safe. At the Beaumont, it was a thrust stage. So there was hardly any safe areas. If it went to my left, it went to my right, if it went in front of me.
Did the audience know this before they came in? I mean, a little disclaimer at the door.
No,
one wanted to sit in the first.
But they would cower,
rows.
You know, in the first couple of rows. Of course, they would cower because I throw the machete into the top of the piano, which is wood, and it sticks there.
With any luck, it sticks. You rehearse it, so it sticks there.
It goes into the wood. It chops right into the board, and then I pull it out. So it's like to show that it is sharp, you know.
And now, after a vacation, you're back on the audition circuit again.
Yes.
after being in New York and have people coming up to you in restaurants and saying, Miss Hayden, I enjoyed your performance.
One time I was in a restaurant and I was having, after the show, I was just, you know, having some soup and had my glasses on, you know, took my contact lenses out. And this man at the table practically next to me was describing this woman that he had seen in this show with this machete. She punctuated her lines with this and this. And I thought, oh my God, he's talking about me and I'm sitting right here.
Did he recognize you?
No, I made sure he didn't recognize me. I was so shy. I just looked at my soup and kept eating.
Well, now just think, he could have been an agent, and if you had turned yourself face forward to him, you might have a job in a few months' time.
No, I think the thing about going back on the audition circuit is, you know, it never stops. Stars have to audition. I mean, major people have to read for movies all the time. It's just a part of your life. It's not very pretty. It's really hard.
Do you expect it to be difficult now because you have just had this wonderful reputation as a, one, good actress, but also someone who twirls a baton, and pretty soon all these baton twirling offers are going to start coming to you?
No, that won't happen. I'm pretty much, you know, I know that I must do a straight play next, and I'm real clear in what choices I have to make. So if somebody did offer something, I would just turn it down. In fact, there was a couple of offers for things for commercials that they needed something, and I just have to turn it down.
You had gained a reputation as an actress in your performances in Barnum, even the initial performances of Comedy of Errors in Chicago, as Sophie Schwab.
Right.
And now here you are as Sophie Hayden.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of risky, isn't it, to change your name in mid-review?
Well, I think I had the thought that, well, I wasn't really that well known. See, when I changed it, I knew I was going to be in this career for a long time, and I never quite liked Sophie Schwab. So I thought, yeah, let's do it. Let's do it. And to change it was very liberating.
Well, let's see. There's Hayden. Does it come from Hayden Planetarium, Sterling Hayden, or Melissa Hayden, the ballet dancer?
When I studied ballet very seriously for years. And I always loved the name Melissa Hayden. I always loved her as a dancer. And when Hayden came up, I thought, Hayden, that's it. I like that. And it's hard to pick a name that goes well with Sophie.
Right. And looks good on the marquee at the same time, right?
So I did it.
Sophie Hayden, thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome. My pleasure.
Actress Sophie Hayden, who, with any luck, won't have to twirl a baton in her next part. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of the news on today's All Things Considered. Renee Montaigne, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Leanne.
What stories are up for us today?
Leanne, tonight a report on the spate of near misses over major cities in recent days. There was one last night over Los Angeles. Also, AIDS in Brazil. Brazil has the second highest reported incidence of the disease in the world, and we have a report about the problems of dealing with AIDS in a country where the public health system is already terribly overburdened.
I understand you'll have the second part of your series on slavery.
Yes, last night, Verda Mae Grosvenor visited a slave mart museum in South Carolina. Tonight, she brings you the voices of former slaves, recordings from the Library of Congress.
Thanks, Renee. All Things Considered is coming up later on National Public Radio. There's more than one way to learn a foreign language. And our language commentator, Jeffrey Nunberg, tells us how he picked up Italian.
There are a lot of reasons for the success of English as a world language, but some credit certainly should go to Hollywood. From Singapore to Paris to Buenos Aires, millions of people have taken their first English lessons from Humphrey Bogart and John Wayne, or in the case of my French-born wife, from Casper the Friendly Ghost. But I have rather a special claim to fame. Bogart and Wayne taught me Italian. This was in 1978, when I was hanging around Rome with a Fulbright fellowship in my pocket and a lot of time on my hands. I didn't know enough Italian to follow Italian movies, so I wound up spending a lot of evenings going to American movies that were dubbed in Italian. These I could follow, since I'd seen them all before. In fact, I soon learned a number of useful Italian expressions. I might not know how to ask for the bus to the stazione, but I knew how to say, "We'll always have Paris." At first, I confess, I found it a little unsettling watching Humphrey Bogart turn to Dooley Wilson in Casablanca and say in this deep Roman voice, "Suonala, Sam." The Italians always used actors with deep voices to dub the heroes of American films, which often sounded funny because very few of our great macho actors have had macho voices. I suppose the Italians would have laughed if anybody had tried to dub Bogart with a realistic lisp or tried to replicate John Wayne's stammering, creaky tenor. After a while, though, the dubbing didn't disconcert me so much anymore. Most people who go to foreign language films in America have a horror of dubbing, as if the whole filmic experience is ruined if they can't hear the actors reciting their lines in the original Czech or Hindi. But actually, you get less out of that authenticity than you might suppose. We have a vivid memory of the voices of English-speaking actors, for example. But can you recall the voices of actors whom you've only heard speaking a language that you don't know, say Gerard Depardieu or Ugo Tognazzi or Brigitte Bardot? Most people can't. It's hard to make anything of a voice when you don't understand the language being spoken. I doubt if the Italians would have appreciated the unusual quality of Bogart's voice, even if they had seen the film with the original soundtrack. Dubbing has another virtue when it's done the Italian way. As it happens, the Italians dub all their films, even the ones with Italian actors. As a result, they don't listen to movie dialogue the way we do, as a recording of what the actors are actually saying as they're being filmed. They tend to think of the voices they hear as a kind of oral subtitle, as if the dialogue were being recited by other actors standing outside the frame. For this reason, they don't think of foreign language films as an exotic entertainment. Italy is a country where ordinary people actually go to see movies made abroad. In fact, the Italian attitude toward foreign films is much closer to what things must have been like in the days before sound, when film relied on action, not language, to make its point. It was only after I'd been living in Italy for a while that I came to appreciate what the great silent directors like Eisenstein were getting at when they said that sound would be the end of the cinema as a genuinely universal art form. Now, I realize that we're not about to adopt the Italian system here. To make it work, you'd have to dub everybody in English, not just Mastroianni and Deneuve, but Barbara Streisand and Woody Allen, too. And I don't imagine people would be willing to put up with that. On the other hand, think what the procedure might do for Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist associated with the Center for the Study of Language and Information at Stanford University.
That no one can deny. It's still the same old story, a fight for love and glory, a case of do or die. The world will always welcome lovers as time goes by.
Here's what's coming up on our next show. On the next edition of Fresh Air, I'll speak with Matt Newman, one of the original writers for Saturday Night Live. He now writes the HBO comedy series Not Necessarily the News. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker will review recent releases by two of country music's brightest stars, Dwight Yoakam and Randy Travis. And film critic Stephen Schiff will review the new Japanese film, Tampopo. So I hope you can join us. We'd like to thank the people who make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty is the production assistant, with additional assistance from Lisa Bruton. Sue Spolin is our research assistant. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Leanne Hansen. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.